Outside the door, at the head of the concrete path leading down to the street, Fred begins to jog slowly in place, taking deep breath after deep breath, depositing the oxygen he will soon withdraw. It is usually the best part of his day, assuming he and Judy don't make love, that is, and lately there has been precious little of that. He likes the feeling, the knowledge, that his path might be the beginning of the road to anywhere, that he could start out here in the Libertyville section of French Landing and wind up in New York, San Francisco, Bombay, the mountain passes of Nepal. Every step outside one's own door invites the world, perhaps even the universe, and this is something Fred Marshall intuitively understands. He sells John Deere tractors and Case cultivators, yes, all right, already, but he is not devoid of imagination. When he and Judy were students at UW-Madison, their first dates were at the coffee house just off campus, an espresso jazz and poetry haven called the Chocolate Watch Band. It would not be entirely unfair to say that they had fallen in love to the sound of angry drunks declaiming the works of Allen Ginsberg and Gary Snyder into the Chocolate Watch Band's cheap but exquisitely loud sound system. Fred draws one more deep breath and begins to run. Down Robin Hood Lane to Maid Marian Way, where he gives Deke Purvis a wave. Deke, in his robe and slippers, is just picking Wendell Green's Daily Dose of Doom up off his own stoop. Then he wheels into Avalon Street, picking it up a little now, showing his heels to the morning. He cannot outrun his worries, however. Judy, 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 he thinks, in the voice of Cary Grant, a little joke that has long since worn thin with the love of his life. There is the gibberish when she sleeps. There's the way her eyes dart hither and yon. And let's not forget the time, just 3 days ago, when he followed her into the kitchen, and she wasn't there. She had turned out to be behind him, coming down the stairs. And how she had done that seems less important to him than why she had done it. Gone sneaking up the back stairs and then come tromping down the front ones, because that is what she must have done. It's the only solution he can think of. There's the constant tapping and petting she does with her tongue. Fred knows what it all adds up to. Judy has been acting like a woman in terror. This has been going on since before the murder of Amy St. Pierre, so it can't be the fisherman, or not entirely the fisherman. And there is a larger issue. Before the last couple of weeks, Fred would have told you that his wife doesn't have a fearful bone in her body. She might be just 5'2", why, you're no bigger than a minute, was his grandmother's comment when she first met Fred's intended. But Judy has the heart of a lion, of a Viking warrior. This isn't bullshit, or hype, or poetic license. It is the simple truth as Fred sees it, and it is the contrast between what he has always known and what he sees now that scares him the most. From Avalon, he races onto Camelot, crossing the intersection without looking for traffic, going much faster than usual, almost sprinting instead of jogging. He is remembering something that happened about a month after they started going out. It was the Chocolate Watch Band they had gone to, as usual, only this time during the afternoon, to listen to a jazz quartet that had actually been pretty good. Not that they had listened very much, as Fred now recalls it. Mostly he had talked to Judy about how little he liked being in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, MU-U, the letters in science snooties called it, and how little he liked the unspoken family assumption that when he graduated he would come on back home and help Phil run the family farm in French Landing. The idea of spending his life in harness with Phil gave Fred a severe case of the glooms. "What do you want, then?" Judy had asked. Holding his hand on the table, a candle burning inside a jelly glass, the combo on stage working a sweet little number called I'll Be There For You. "I don't know," he'd said, "but I tell you what, Jude, I should be in business admin, not MU-U. I'm a hell of a lot better at selling than at planting." "Then why don't you switch?" "Because my family thinks your family isn't going to have to live your life, Fred. You are." Talk is cheap, he remembers thinking, but then something had happened on the way back to campus. Something so amazing and out of his understanding of how life was supposed to work that it fills him with wonder even now, some 13 years later. "Still talking about his future and their future together, I could be a farm wife," Judy had said, "but only if my husband really wants to be a farmer." deep into that, letting their feet carry them along without much interest in exactly where they were. And then, at the intersection of State Street and Gorham, a scream of brakes and a hearty metallic bang had interrupted the conversation. Fred and Judy had looked around and seen a Dodge pickup that had just tangled bumpers with an elderly Ford station wagon. Getting out of the wagon, which had pretty clearly run the stop sign at the end of Gorham Street, was a middle-aged man in a middle-aged brown suit. He looked scared as well as shaken up, and Fred thought there was good reason for that. The man advancing toward him from the pickup truck was young, heavy-set. Fred particularly remembered the belly bulging over the waist of his jeans, and carrying a tire iron. "You goddamn careless asshole," young and heavy-set cried. "Look what you done to my truck. This is my dad's truck, you goddamn asshole." Middle-aged suit backing up, eyes wide, hands raised, Fred watching fascinated from in front of Rickman's Hardware, thinking, "Oh no, mister, bad idea. You don't back away from a guy like this. You go toward him, even as mad as he is. You're provoking him. Can't you see that you're provoking him?" So fascinated, he didn't realize that Judy's hand was no longer in his, listening with a kind of sick foreknowledge as Mr. Middle-Aged Suit, still backing up, blathered about how he was sorry, entirely his fault. Wasn't looking, wasn't thinking, insurance papers, State Farm, draw a diagram, get a policeman to take statements. And all the time, young and heavyset was advancing, thwacking the end of the tire iron into the palm of his hand, not listening. This wasn't about insurance or compensation. This was about how Mr. Middle-Aged Suit had scared the shit out of him while he was just driving along and minding his own business and listening to Johnny Paycheck sing "Take This Job and Shove It." Young and Heavyset intended to take a little payback paycheck of his own for getting the shit scared out of him and all jounced around behind the wheel. Had to take a little because the other man's smell was inciting him, that piss-yellow smell of fear and innate defenselessness. It was a case of rabbit and farmyard dog, and all at once the rabbit was clean out of backing room. Mr. Middle-Aged Suit was pressed against the side of his station wagon, and in a moment the tire iron was going to start swinging and the blood was going to start flying. Except there was no blood and not a single swing, because all at once Judy DeLois was there, no bigger than a minute, but standing between them, looking fearlessly up into young and heavyset's burning face. Fred blinked, wondering how in the name of God she'd gotten there so damn fast. Much later, he would feel the same way when he followed her into the kitchen, only to hear the steady thump of her feet descending the front stairs. And then Judy slapped young and heavyset's arm. Whack! Right on the meaty bicep, she slapped him, leaving a white palm print on the sunburned, freckled flesh below the sleeve of the guy's torn blue T-shirt. Fred saw it, but couldn't believe it. "Quit it!" Judy shouted up into young and heavyset's surprised, beginning to be bewildered face. "Put it down. Quit it. Don't be dumb. You want to go to jail over $700 worth of body work? Put it down. Get it together, big boy. Put that thing down." There had been one second when Fred was quite sure young and heavyset was going to bring the tire iron down anyway, and right on his pretty little girlfriend's head. But Judy never flinched. Her eyes never left the eyes of the young man with the tire iron, who towered at least a foot over and must have outweighed her by a couple of 100 pounds. There was certainly no pissy yellow fear smell coming off her that day. Her tongue did no nervous patting at her upper lip or her philtrum. Her blazing eyes were steadfast. And, after another moment, young and heavyset put the tire iron down. Fred wasn't aware that a crowd had gathered until he heard the spontaneous applause from perhaps 30 onlookers. He joined in, never more proud of her than he was at that moment. And for the first time, Judy looked startled. She hung in there, though, startled or not. She got the two of them together, tugging Mr. Middle-Aged Suit forward by one arm, and actually hectored them into shaking hands. By the time the cops arrived, young and heavyset and Mr. Middle-Aged Suit were sitting side by side on the curb, studying each other's insurance papers. Case closed. Fred and Judy walked on toward the campus, holding hands again. For 2 blocks, Fred didn't speak. Was he in awe of her? He supposes now that he was. At last he said, "That was amazing." She gave him an uncomfortable little look, an uncomfortable little smile. "No, it wasn't," she said. "If you want to call it something, call it good citizenship. I could see that guy getting ready to send himself to jail. I didn't want that to happen, or the other guy to be hurt. Yet she said that last almost as an afterthought, and Fred for the first time sensed not only her courage, but her unflinching Viking's heart. She was on the side of young and heavyset because the other fellow had been afraid. "Weren't you worried, though?" he asked her. He had still been so stunned by what he'd seen that it hadn't crossed his mind, yet, to think he should be a little ashamed. After all, it was his girlfriend who'd stepped in instead of him, and that wasn't the gospel according to Hollywood. "Weren't you afraid that in the heat of the moment, the guy with the tire iron would take a swing at you?" Judy's eyes had grown puzzled. "It never crossed my mind," she said. Camelot eventually debouches into Chase Street, where there is a pleasant little gleam of the Mississippi on clear days like this one. But Fred doesn't go that far. He turns at the top of Liberty Heights and starts back the way he came, his shirt now soaked with sweat. Usually the run makes him feel better, but not today, at least not yet. The fearless Judy of that afternoon on the corner of State and Gorham is so unlike the shifty-eyed, sometimes disconnected Judy who now lives in his house, the nap-taking, hand-wringing Judy, that Fred has actually spoken to Pat Skarda about it. Yesterday, this was, when the doc was in Goltz's, looking at riding lawnmowers. Fred had shown him a couple, a Deer and a Honda, inquired after his family, and then asked, casually, he hoped, "Hey, Doc, tell me something. Do you think it's possible for a person to just go crazy, without any warning, like?" Skarda had given him a sharper look than Fred had really liked. "Are we talking about an adult or an adolescent, Fred?" "Well, we're not talking about anyone, actually." Big, hearty laugh, unconvincing to Fred's own ears, and judging from Pat Skarda's look, not very convincing to him either. "Not anyone real, anyway. But as a hypothetical case, let's say an adult." Skarda had thought about it, then shook his head. "There are few absolutes in medicine, even fewer in psychiatric medicine. That said, I have to tell you that I think it's very unlikely for a person to just go crazy. It may be a fairly rapid process, but it is a process. We hear people say so-and-so snapped, but that's rarely the case. Mental dysfunction, neurotic or psychotic behavior, takes time to develop, and there are usually signs. How's your mom these days, Fred?" "Mom? Oh, hey, she's fine, right in the pink." "And Judy?" It had taken him a moment to get a smile started, but once he did, he managed a big one, big and guileless. "Judy? She's in the pink too, Doc. Of course she is, steady as she goes." Sure, steady as she goes. Just showing a few signs, that was all. Maybe they'll pass, he thinks. Those good old endorphins are finally kicking in, and all at once this seems plausible. Optimism is a more normal state for Fred, who does not believe in slippage. And a little smile breaks on his face, the day's first. Maybe the signs will pass. Maybe whatever's wrong with her will blow out as fast as it blew in. Maybe it's even, you know, a menstrual thing, like PMS. God, if that was all it was, what a relief! In the meantime, there's Ty to think about. He has to have a talk with Tyler about the buddy system, because while Fred doesn't believe what Wendell Green is apparently trying to insinuate, that the ghost of a fabulous turn-of-the-century cannibal and all-around booger man named Albert Fish has for some reason turned up here in Coolie Country, someone is certainly out there, and this someone has murdered two little children and done unspeakable, at least unless you're Wendell Green, it seems, things to the bodies. Thighs, torso, and buttocks bitten, Fred thinks, and runs faster, although now he's getting a stitch in his side. Yet, this bears repeating. He does not believe that these horrors can actually touch his son, nor does he see how they can have caused Judy's condition, since her oddities started while Amy St. Pierre was still alive, Johnny Erkenham too, both of them presumably playing happily in their respective backyards. Maybe this, maybe that, but enough of Fred and his worries, all right? Let us rise from the environs of his troubled head and precede him back to number 16 Robin Hood Lane. Let's go directly to the source of his troubles. The upstairs window of the connubial bedroom is open, and the screen is certainly no problem. We strain ourselves right through, entering with the breeze and the first sounds of the awakening day. The sounds of French Landing awakening do not awaken Judy Marshall. Nope. She has been starry-eyed since 3, conning the shadows for she doesn't know what, fleeing dreams too horrible to remember. Yet she does remember some things, little as she wants to. "Saw the eye again," she remarks to the empty room. Her tongue comes out, and with no Fred around to watch her, she knows he's watching, she is beset, but not stupid, it does not just pet at her philtrum, but slathers it in a great big wipe, like a dog licking its chops after a bowl of scraps. "It's a red eye. His eye. Eye of the king." She looks up at the shadows of the trees outside. They dance on the ceiling, making shapes and faces, shapes and faces. "Eye of the king," she repeats. And now it starts with the hands, kneading and twisting and squeezing and digging. "Abala, foxes down foxholes, Abala Doon, the crimson king, rats in their rat holes, Abala Munchun, the king is in his tower eating bread and honey, the breakers in the basement making all the money." She shakes her head from side to side. Oh, these voices, out of the darkness they come, and sometimes she awakens with a vision burning behind her eyes, a vision of a vast slaty tower standing in a field of roses, a field of blood. Then the talking begins, the speaking in tongues, testification, words she can't understand, let alone control, a mixed stream of English and gibberish. "Trudge, trudge, trudge," she says. "The little ones are trudging on their bleeding footsies. Oh, for Christ's sake, won't this ever stop?" Her tongue yawns out and licks across the tip of her nose. For a moment, her nostrils are plugged with her own spit, and her head roars, "Abala, Abala Doon, Kanta Abala," with those terrible foreign words, those terrible impacted images of the tower and the burning caves beneath, caves through which little ones trudge on bleeding feet. Her mind strains with them, and there is only one thing that will make them stop, only one way to get relief. Judy Marshall sits up. On the table beside her, there is a lamp, a copy of the latest John Grisham novel, a little pad of paper, a birthday present from Ty, each sheet headed, "Here's another great idea I had," and a ballpoint pen with La Riviere Sheraton printed on the side. Judy seizes the pen and scribbles on the pad, "No Abala, no Abala Doon, no tower, no breakers, no crimson king, only dreams, these are just my dreams." It is enough. But pens are also roads to anywhere. And before she can divorce the tip of this one from the birthday pad, it writes one more line. "The black house is the doorway to Abala, the entrance to hell. Sheol, Munchun, all these worlds and spirits. No more. Good merciful God, no more. And the worst thing, what if it all begins to make sense?" She throws the pen back on the table, where it rolls to the base of the lamp and lies still. Then she tears the page from the pad, crumples it, and sticks it in her mouth. She chews furiously, not tearing it, but at least mashing it sodden, then swallows. There is an awful moment when it sticks in her throat, but then it goes down. Words and worlds recede, and Judy falls back against the pillows, exhausted. Her face is pale and sweaty, her eyes huge with unshed tears, but the moving shadows on the ceiling no longer look like faces to her, the faces of trudging children, of rats in their rat holes, foxes in foxholes, eye of the king, Abala, Abala Doon. Now they are just the shadows of the trees again. She is Judy DeLois Marshall, wife of Fred, mother of Ty. This is Libertyville, this is French Landing, this is French County, this is Wisconsin, this is America, this is the Northern Hemisphere, this is the world, and there is no other world than this. Let it be so. Ah, let it be so. Her eyes close, and as she finally slips back to sleep, we slip across the room to the door. But just before we get there, Judy Marshall says one other thing, says it as she crosses over the border and into sleep. Burnside is not your name. Where is your hole? The bedroom door is closed, and so we use the keyhole, passing through it like a sigh. Down the hall we go, past pictures of Judy's family and Fred's, including one photo of the Marshall family farm, where Fred and Judy spent a horrible but blessedly short period not long after their marriage. Want some good advice? Don't talk to Judy Marshall about Fred's brother Phil. Just don't get her started, as George Rathbun would undoubtedly say. No keyhole in the door at the end of the hall, and so we slide underneath like a telegram, and into a room we immediately know is a boys' room. We can tell from the mingled smells of dirty athletic socks and neat's foot oil. It's small, this room, but it seems bigger than Fred's and Judy's down the hall, very likely because the odor of anxiety is missing. On the walls are pictures of Shaquille O'Neal, Jeremy Burnett's, last year's Milwaukee Bucks team, and Tyler Marshall's idol, Mark McGwire. McGwire plays for the Cards, and the Cards are the enemy, but hell, it's not as if the Milwaukee Brewers are actually competition for anything. The Brew Crew were doormats in the American League, and they are likewise doormats in the National. And McGwire, well, he's a hero, isn't he? He's strong, he's modest, and he can hit the baseball a country mile. Even Tyler's dad, who roots strictly for Wisconsin teams, thinks McGwire is something special. The greatest hitter in the history of the game, he called him after the 70 home run season, and Tyler, although little more than an infant in that fabled year, has never forgotten this. Also, on the wall of this little boy, who will soon be the fisherman's fourth victim, yes, there has already been a third, as we have seen, holding pride of place directly over his bed, is a travel poster showing a great dark castle at the end of a long and misty meadow. At the bottom of the poster, which he has scotch taped to the wall, his mom absolutely forbids pushpins, it says, "Come back to the old sod," in big green letters. Ty is considering taking the poster down long enough to cut this part off. He doesn't like the poster because he has any interest in Ireland. To him, the picture whispers of somewhere else. Somewhere entirely else. It is like a photograph of some splendid, mythical kingdom where there might be unicorns in the forests and dragons in the caves. Never mind Ireland, never mind Harry Potter either. Hogwarts is fine enough for summer afternoons, but this is a castle in the kingdom of entirely else. It's the first thing Tyler Marshall sees in the morning, the last thing he sees at night, and that's just the way he likes it. He lies, curled on his side in his underwear shorts, a human comma with tousled dark blonde hair, and a thumb that is close to his mouth, really just an inch or so away from being sucked. He is dreaming. We can see his eyeballs moving back and forth behind his closed lids. His lips move. He's whispering something. Abala? Is he whispering his mother's word? Surely not, but... We lean closer to listen, but before we can hear anything, a circuit in Tyler's jazzy red clock radio goes hot, and all at once the voice of George Rathbun fills the room, calling Tyler hence from whatever dreams have been playing themselves out under that tousled thatch. "Fans, you gotta listen to me now. How many times have I told you this? If you don't know Henry Brothers Furniture or French Landing in Centralia, then you don't know furniture. That's right. I'm talking Henry Brothers, home of the colonial blowout. Living room sets, dining room sets, bedroom sets, famous names you know and trust like Lazy Boy, Bretton Woods, and Moosehead. Even a blind man can see that Henry Brothers means quality." Ty Marshall is laughing even before he's got both eyes fully open. He loves George Rathbun. George is absolutely fly. And now, without even changing gears from the commercial, "You guys are all ready for the Brewer Bash, ain't ya? Sent me those postcards with your name, address, and El Telefono on them? Hope so, because the contest closed at midnight. If you missed out, so sully chully." Ty closes his eyes again and mouths the same word over three times. Shit, shit, shit. He did forget to enter, and now he can only hope that his dad, who knows how forgetful his son can be, remembered and entered the contest for him. grand prize, George is saying. Only the chance for you or the favorite young person of your acquaintance to be the Brew Crew's Bat Boy or Bat Girl for the entire Cincinnati series. Only the chance to win an autographed Richie Sexson bat, the lumber that holds the lightning. Not to mention 50 free seats on the first base side with me, George Rathman, Cooley Country's traveling college of baseball knowledge. But why am I telling you this? If you missed out, you're too late. Case closed. Game over. Zip up your fly. Oh, I know why I brought it up. To make sure you tune in next Friday to see if I speak your name over the radio. Ty groans. There are only two chances that George will speak his name over the radio, slim and none. Not that he cared so much about being a bat boy dressed in a baggy brewer's uni and running around in front of all those people at Miller Park. But to own Richie Sexson's own bat, the lumber with the lightning, how boss would that have been? Tyler rolls out of bed, sniffs the armpits of yesterday's T-shirt, tosses it aside, gets another out of the drawer. His dad sometimes asks him why he sets his alarm so early. It's summer vacation, after all, and Tyler can't seem to make him understand that every day is important, especially those filled with warmth and sunlight and no particular responsibilities. It's as if there's some little voice deep inside him warning him not to waste a minute, not a single one, because time is short. What George Rathman says next drives the remaining sleep fog from Tyler's brain. It's like a dash of cold water. Say there, Cooley. Want to talk about the fisherman? Tyler stops what he's doing, an odd little chill running up his back and then down his arms. The fisherman. Some crazy guy killing kids and eating them? Well, he's heard that rumor, mostly from the bigger kids down at the baseball field or at the French Landing Rec Center. But who would do something so gross? Cannibalism. Ech! George's voice drops. Now, I'm going to tell you a little secret, so listen close to your Uncle George. Tyler sits on his bed, holding his sneakers by the laces and listening closely to his Uncle George, as bidden. It seems odd to hear George Rathman talking about a subject so unsporty, but Tyler trusts him. Didn't George Rathman predict that the Badgers would go to at least the Elite Eight 2 years ago, when everyone else said they'd get blown out in the first round of the big dance? Yeah, he did. Case closed. Game over. Zip up your fly. George's voice drops further, to what is almost a confidential whisper. The original fisherman, boys and girls, Albert Fish, has been dead and gone for 67 years, and as far as I know, he never got much west of New Jersey. Furthermore, he was probably a damn Yankee fan. So cool it, Cooley Country. Just calm down. Tyler relaxes, smiling, and starts putting on his sneakers. Calm down, you got that right. The day is new, and yeah, okay, his mom's been a little on the tinky-winky side lately, but she'll pull out of it. Let us leave on this optimistic note. Make like an amoeba and split, as the redoubtable George Rathman might say. And speaking of George, that ubiquitous voice of the Cooley Country morning, should we not seek him out? Not a bad idea. Let us do so immediately. Chapter 3. Out Tyler's window we go, away from Libertyville, flying southwest on a diagonal, not lingering now but really flapping those old wings, flying with a purpose. We're headed toward the heliograph flash of early morning sun on the Father of Waters, also toward the world's largest six-pack. Between it and County Road 00, we can call it Nail House Row if you want, we're practically honorary citizens of French Landing now, is a radio tower. The warning beacon on top now invisible in the bright sunshine of this newborn July day. We smell grass and trees and warming earth, and as we draw closer to the tower, we also smell the yeasty, fecund aroma of beer. Next to the radio tower in the industrial park on the east side of Peninsula Drive is a little cinder block building with a parking lot just big enough for half a dozen cars and the Cooley patrol van, an aging Ford Econoline painted candy apple pink. As the day winds down and afternoon wears into evening, The cylindrical shadows of the six-pack will fall first over the sign on the balding lawn facing the drive, then the building, then the parking lot. KDCUAM, this sign reads, your talk voice in Coolie Country. Spray-painted across it in a pink that almost matches the patrol van is a fervent declaration. Troy loves Marianne. Yes. Later on, Howie Soul, the U-Crew engineer, will clean this off, probably during the Rush Limbaugh show, which is satellite-fed and totally automated. But for now it stays, telling us all we need to know about small-town love in Middle America. Looks like we found something nice after all. Coming out of the station side door as we arrive is a slender man dressed in pleated khaki dockers, a tie-less white shirt of Egyptian cotton buttoned all the way to the neck, and maroon braces. They are as slim as he is, those braces, and far too cool to be called suspenders. Suspenders are vulgar things worn by such creatures as Chipper Maxton and Sonny Hartfield down at the funeral home. This silver-haired fellow is also wearing a very sharp straw fedora, antique but beautifully kept. The maroon hatband matches his braces. Aviator-style sunglasses cover his eyes. He takes a position on the grass to the left of the door, beneath a battered speaker that is amping KDCU's current broadcast, the local news. This will be followed by the Chicago Farm Report, which gives him 10 minutes before he has to settle in behind the mic again. We watch in growing puzzlement as he produces a pack of American Spirit cigarettes from his shirt pocket and fires one up with a gold lighter. Surely this elegant fellow in the braces, dockers, and Bass-Weegans cannot be George Rathbun. In our minds, we have already built up a picture of George, and it is one of a fellow very different from this. In our mind's eye, we see a guy with a huge belly hanging over the white belt of his checked pants, all those ballpark bratwursts, a brick-red complexion, all those ballpark beers, not to mention all that bellowing at the dastardly umps, and a squat, broad neck, perfect for housing those asbestos vocal cords. The George Rathbun of our imagination, and all of Coolie Country's, it almost goes without saying, is a pop-eyed, broad-assed, wild-haired, leather-lunged, Rolaids-popping, Chevy-driving, Republican-voting heart attack waiting to happen, a churning urn of sports trivia, mad enthusiasms, crazy prejudices, and high cholesterol. This fellow is not that fellow. This fellow moves like a dancer. This fellow is iced tea on a hot day, cool as the King of Spades. But say, that's the joke of it, isn't it? The joke of the fat DJ with the skinny voice only turned inside out. In a very real sense, George Rathbun does not exist at all. He is a hobby in action, a fiction in the flesh, and only one of the slim man's multiple personalities. The people at KDCU know his real name and think they're in on the joke, the punchline, of course, being George's trademark line, the even a blind man thing. But they don't know the half of it. Nor is this a metaphorical statement. They know exactly one-third of it. Because the man in the dockers and the straw fedora is actually four people. In any case, George Rathbun has been the saving of KDCU, the last surviving AM station in a predatory FM market. For 5 mornings a week, week in and week out, he has been a drive-time bonanza. The U-Crew, as they call themselves, love him just about to death. Above him, the loudspeaker cackles on. Still no leads, according to Chief Dale Gilbertson, who has called Herald reporter Wendell Green an out-of-town fearmonger who is more interested in selling papers than in how we do things in French Landing. Meanwhile, in Arden, a house fire has taken the lives of an elderly farmer and his wife, Horst P. Leppelmeyer and his wife Gertrude, both 82. Horst P. Leppelmeyer, says the slim man, drawing on his cigarette with what appears to be great enjoyment. Try saying that one 10 times fast, you moke. Behind him and to his right, the door opens again, and although the smoker is still standing directly beneath the speaker, he hears the door perfectly well. The eyes behind the aviator shades have been dead his whole life, but his hearing is exquisite. The newcomer is pasty-faced and comes blinking into the morning sun like a baby mole that has just been turned out of its burrow by the blade of a passing plow. His head has been shaved, except for the mohawk strip up the center of his skull and the pigtail that starts just above the nape of his neck and hangs to his shoulder blades. The mohawk has been dyed bright red. The tail is electric blue. Dangling from one earlobe is a lightning bolt earring that looks suspiciously like the Nazi SS insignia. He is wearing a torn black T-shirt with a logo that reads Sniveling Shits 97, the We Get Hard for Jesus tour. In one hand, this colorful fellow has a CD jewel box. "Hello, Morris," says the slim man in the fedora, still without turning. Morris pulls in a little gasp, and in his surprise looks like the nice Jewish boy that he actually is. Morris Rosen is the U-Crew's summer intern from the Oshkosh branch of UW. "Man, I love that unpaid grunt labor," station manager Tom Wiggins has been heard to say, usually while rubbing his hands together fiendishly. Never has a checkbook been guarded so righteously as the Wigger guards the KDCU checkbook. He is like Smaug the Dragon reclining on his heaps of gold. Not that there are heaps of anything in the DCU accounts. It bears repeating to say that as an AM talker, the station is lucky just to be alive. Morris's look of surprise, it might be fair to call it uneasy surprise, dissolves into a smile. "Wow, Mr. Layden, good grab. What a pair of ears." Then he frowns. Even if Mr. Layden, who's standing directly beneath the outside honker, can't forget that, heard someone come out, how in God's name did he know which someone it was? "How'd you know it was me?" he asks. "Only two people around here smell like marijuana in the morning," Henry Layden says. "One of them follows his morning smoke with scope. The other, that's you, Morris, just lets her rip." "Wow," Morris says respectfully. "That is totally bitch rod." "I am totally bitch rod," Henry agrees. He speaks softly and thoughtfully. "It's a tough job, but somebody has to do it. In regard to your morning rendezvous with the undeniably tasty tie stick, may I offer an Appalachian aphorism?" "Go, dude." This is Morris's first real discussion with Henry Layden, who is every bit the head Morris has been told to expect, every bit and more. It is no longer so hard to believe that he could have another identity, a secret identity like Bruce Wayne. But still, this is just so pimp. "What we do in our childhood forms as a habit," Henry says, in the same soft, totally un-George Rathbun voice. "That is my advice to you, Morris." "Yeah, totally," Morris says. He has no clue what Mr. Layden is talking about. But he slowly, shyly extends the CD jewel box in his hand. For a moment, when Henry makes no move to take it, Morris feels crushed, all at once 7 years old again and trying to wow his always too busy father with a picture he spent all afternoon drawing in his room. Then he thinks, he's blind, dickweed. He may be able to smell pot in your breath and he may have ears like a bat, but how's he supposed to know you're holding out a fucking CD? Hesitantly, a bit frightened by his own temerity, Morris takes Henry's wrist. He feels the man start a little, but then Layden allows his hand to be guided to the slender box. "Ah, a CD," Henry says. "And what is it, pray tell?" "You gotta play the 7th track tonight on your show," Morris says. "Please." For the first time, Henry looks alarmed. He takes a drag on his cigarette, then drops it, without even looking, of course, ha-ha, into the sand-filled plastic bucket by the door. "What show could you possibly mean?" he asks. Instead of answering directly, Morris makes a rapid little smacking noise with his lips, the sound of a small but voracious carnivore eating something tasty. And to make things worse, he follows it with the Wisconsin Rat's trademark line, as well known to the folks in Morris's age group as George Rathbun's hoarse, even a blind man cry is known to their elders. "Chew it up, eat it up, wash it down, it all comes out the same place." He doesn't do it very well, but there's no question who he's doing. The one and only Wisconsin Rat, whose evening drive-time program on KWLA-FM is famous in Coolie Country, except the word we probably want is infamous. KWLA is the tiny college FM station in La Riviere, hardly more than a smudge on the wallpaper of Wisconsin radio, but the Rat's audience is huge. And if anyone found out that the comfortable brew crew rooting Republican voting AM broadcasting George Rathbun was also the Rat, who had once narrated a gleeful on-air evacuation of his bowels onto a Backstreet Boys CD, there could be trouble. Quite serious, possibly, resounding well beyond the tight-knit little radio community. What, in God's name, would ever make you think that I'm the Wisconsin Rat, Morris? Henry asks. I barely know who you're talking about. Who put such a weird idea in your head? An informed source, Morris says craftily. He won't give Howie Soul up, not even if they pull out his fingernails with red-hot tongs. Besides, Howie only found out by accident, went into the station crapper one day after Henry left, and discovered that Henry's wallet had fallen out of his back pocket while he was sitting on the throne. You'd have thought a fellow whose other senses were so obviously tight-wired would have sensed the absence. But probably Henry's mind had been on other things. He was obviously a heavy dude who undoubtedly spent his days getting through some heavy thoughts. In any case, there was a KWLA ID card in Henry's wallet, which Howie had thumbed through in the spirit of friendly curiosity, as he put it, and on the line marked name, someone had stamped a little ink pad drawing of a rat. Case closed, game over, zip up your fly. I have never in my life so much as stepped through the door of KWLA, Henry says, and this is the absolute truth. He makes the Wisconsin Rat tapes, among others, in his studio at home, then sends them into the station from the downtown mailboxes, etc., where he rents under the name of Joe Strummer. The card with the rat stamped on it was more in the nature of an invitation from the KWLA staff than anything else, one he's never taken up, but he kept the card. Have you become anyone else's informed source, Morris? Huh? Have you told anyone that you think I'm the Wisconsin Rat? No, of course not, which, as we all know, is what people always say. Luckily for Henry, in this case, it happens to be true. So far, at least, but the day is still young. And you won't, will you? Because rumors have a way of taking root, just like certain bad habits. Henry mimes puffing, pulling in smoke. I know how to keep my mouth shut, Morris declares, with perhaps misplaced pride. I hope so. Because if you brooded this about, I'd have to kill you. Brooded, Morris thinks. Oh, man, this guy is complete. Kill me, yeah, Morris says, laughing. And eat you, Henry says. He is not laughing, not even smiling. Yeah, right. Morris laughs again, but this time the laugh sounds strangely forced to his own ears. Like your Hannibal lecture. No. Like I'm the fisherman, Henry says. He slowly turns his aviator sunglasses toward Morris. The sun reflects off them for a moment, turning them into Rufus eyes of fire. Morris takes a step back without even realizing that he has done so. Albert Fish liked to start with the ass. Did you know that? Yes, indeed. He claimed that a good piece of young ass was as sweet as a veal cutlet. His exact words, written in a letter to the mother of one of his victims. Far out, Morris says. His voice sounds faint to his own ears, the voice of a plump little pig denying entrance to the big bad wolf. But I'm not exactly, like, worried that you're the fisherman. No. Why not? Man, you're blind, for one thing. Henry says nothing, only stares at the now vastly uneasy Morris with his fiery glass eyes. And Morris thinks, but is he blind? He gets around pretty good for a blind guy. And the way he tabbed me as soon as I came out here, how weird was that? I'll keep quiet, he says, honest to God. That's all I want, Henry says mildly. Now that we've got that straight, what exactly have you brought me? He holds up the CD, but not as if he's looking at it, Morris observes with vast relief. It's This Racine group, Dirty Sperm, and they've got this cover of Where Did Our Love Go, the old Supremes thing, only they do it at like 150 beats a minute. It's fucking hilarious. I mean, it destroys the whole pop thing, man. Blitzes it. Dirty Sperm, Henry says. Didn't they used to be Jane Wyatt's clit? Morris looks at Henry with awe that could easily become love. Dirty Sperm's lead guitarist, like, formed JWC, man. Then him and the bass guy had this political falling out, something about Dean Kissinger and Henry Acheson, and Ucky Ducky, he's the guitarist, went off to form Dirty Sperm. Where did our love go? Henry muses, then hands the CD back. And as if he sees the way Morris's face falls, I can't be seen with something like that. Use your head, stick it in my locker. Morris's gloom disappears, and he breaks into a sunny smile. Yeah, okay, you got it, Mr. Layden. And don't let anyone see you doing it, especially not Howie Soul. Howie's a bit of a snoop. You'd do well not to emulate him. No way, baby. Still smiling, delighted at how all this has gone, Morris reaches for the door handle. And Morris? Yeah? Since you know my secret, perhaps you'd better call me Henry. Henry? Yeah. Is this the best morning of the summer for Morris Rosen? You better believe it. And something else? Yeah? Henry? Morris dares imagine a day when they will progress to Hank and Maury. Keep your mouth shut about the rat. I already told you yes, and I believe you. But temptation comes creeping, Morris. Temptation comes creeping like a thief in the night, or like a killer in search of prey. If you give in to temptation, I'll know. I'll smell it on your skin like bad cologne. Do you believe me? Yeah. And he does. Later, when he has time to kick back and reflect, Morris will think what a ridiculous idea that is. But yes, at the time, he believes it. Believes him. It's like being hypnotized. Very good. Now off you go. I want Ace Hardware, Zaglatt Chevy, and Mr. Tasty Ribs all queued up for the first sag. Gotcha. Also last night's game. Wickman striking out the side in the eighth, that was pimp. Totally like un-Brewers. No, I think we want the Mark Loretta home run in the fifth. Loretta doesn't hit many, and the fans like him. I can't think why. Even a blind man can see he has no range, especially from deep in the hole. Go on, son, put the CD in my locker, and if I see the rat, I'll give it to him. I'm sure he'll give it a spin. The track seven. Seven rhymes with heaven. I won't forget, and neither will he. Go on now. Morris gives him a final, grateful look and goes back inside. Henry Layden, alias George Rathbun, alias the Wisconsin Rat, also alias Henry Shake, we'll get to that one, but not now, the hour draweth late, lights another cigarette and drags deep. He won't have time to finish it. The farm report is already in full flight, hog bellies up, wheat futures down, and the corn as high as an elephant's eye. But he needs a couple of drags just now to steady himself. A long, long day stretches out ahead of him, ending with the strawberry fest hop at Maxton Elder Care, that house of antiquarian horrors. God save him from the clutches of William Chipper Maxton, he has often thought. Given a choice between ending his days at MEC and burning his face off with a blowtorch, he would reach for the blowtorch every time. Later, if he's not totally exhausted, perhaps his friend from up the road will come over and they can begin the long-promised reading of Bleak House. That would be a treat. How long, he wonders, can Morris Rosen hold on to his momentous secret? Well, Henry supposes he will find that out. He likes the rat too much to give him up unless he absolutely has to. That much is an undeniable fact. Dean Kissinger, he murmurs. Henry Acheson. Ucky ducky, God save us. He takes another drag on his cigarette, then drops it into the bucket of sand. It is time to go back inside. Time to replay last night's Mark Loretta home run. Time to start taking more calls from the coolie country's dedicated sports fans. And time for us to be off. 7 o'clock has rung from the Lutheran Church steeple. In French Landing, things are getting into high gear. No one lies abed long in this part of the world, and we must speed along to the end of our tour. Things are going to start happening soon, and they may happen fast. Still, we have done well, and we have only one more stop to make before arriving at our final destination. We rise on the warm summer updrafts and hover for a moment by the KDCU tower. We are close enough to hear the tick-tick-tick of the beacon and the low, rather sinister hum of electricity, looking north and taking our bearings. 8 miles upriver is the town of Great Bluff, named for the limestone outcropping that rises there. The outcropping is reputed to be haunted, because in 1888 a chief of the Fox Indian tribe, Far Eyes was his name, assembled all his warriors, shamans, squaws, and children, and told them to leap to their deaths, thereby escaping some hideous fate he had glimpsed in his dreams. Far Eyes' followers, like Jim Jones's, did as they were bidden. We won't go that far upriver, however. We have enough ghosts to deal with right here in French Landing. Let us instead fly over Nail House Row once more. The Harleys are gone. Beezer St. Pierre has led the Thunder Five off to their day's work at the brewery. Over Queen Street and Maxton Elder Care, Bernie's down there, still looking out his window. Ugh. To Bluff Street. This is almost the countryside again. Even now, in the 21st century, the towns in Coulee Country give up quickly to the woods and the fields. Herman Street is a left turn from Bluff Street, in an area that is not quite town and not quite city. Here, in a sturdy brick house sitting at the end of a half-mile meadow as yet undiscovered by the developers, even here there are a few developers, unknowing agents of slippage, lives Dale Gilbertson with his wife Sarah and his 6-year-old son David.